Radio Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelley.
February 17, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. This is the show you were looking for, the O'Shelley Effect. And how do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it is Thursday, and second to last broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelley Effect, for sure. Things are going to start to change, and we're going to talk about that in the coming days. Probably on Friday, I'll get into the upcoming change to when I'm going to be live, what's going to be happening, and exactly where that's going to go, because starting right about at the end of this month, there's going to be some changes in my schedule. So we're still going to do the same thing, but it's going to be a little longer, a little stronger, and in a lot more places. So stick around and get that information tomorrow night when we do the call-in show. But let's get through tonight, where we're going to get well informed about a great many things. Why? Because in the first hour, I've got Mike Swanson, the man behind WallStreetWindow.com. Now, he might not be with me next week, but I assure you, he'll be with me many other weeks, and I'm so happy that he's doing the Thursdays now. In the second hour, this week, we have Larry Hancock with us, and I almost feel bad. Like, I asked Larry to rotate every other Thursday on the show, and frankly, I didn't expect him to be my Ukraine guy all the time, but that's still happening. So we're going to talk about Putin and his strategies and whatnot, and maybe get into the collected energy strategy in the second hour. But like I said, until we get there, the author of The War State, the author of Why the Vietnam War. Yes, two books I recommend. You can see them on my website. Click through, buy them, get them any which way you can, for sure. I have them on my bookshelf, and you need them. Anyways, be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. Although, I might have to ask Mike a few things about what's going on. I'm seeing manufacturing numbers, inflationary numbers, etc. And, look, I'm not a money guy. I have my thoughts, I have my issues, I have my experience in life, and I'm definitely experiencing the squeeze everybody else is, and have been for a long time. Also noticing that in a place where you do pay less to live, that's where the percentages get, scorchingly high real fast. You know, the rate of inflation is going up faster in Georgia than it is in New York. Although I still couldn't afford to live in New York, I assure you. There's a lot going on, man. There's just a lot. Anyway, let's get to somebody way smarter than me, Mike Swanson. How are you, sir, first of all?
Oh, I'm doing good. It's good to talk to you and everyone else. We had a little trouble getting on here. My Skype is going crazy, but we got it kinks worked out, and I think everything sounds good now.
Oh, there we go. Oh, is that you in the chat room, Mike, live on O'Shelley?
Is it? Yeah, that's me. It is me, actually.
Okay, cool. No, you got to be careful.
I might drop some links in of some news items that I might talk about.
Listen,
during the show.
Excellent, because I'm glad you're in there. It's so, but I got to watch, because sometimes people make names up and they're trying to be somebody else.
I thought that as soon as I typed that in, people weren't going to be sure that's me or not, because I never used that before.
Well, let's just say somebody didn't like you. They might go in the chat room and say, you know, I'm Mike Swanson, and then they say terrible things.
There's only three or four people that don't like me that I know.
No, I know. Look, you're a likable guy. I'm not saying that if anything, people are going to do that against me, but you know, but it's okay. I don't care. All right, back to it though. You do have some stuff on your mind, but like I said, I'm noting that let's start with the money issue, okay? Because you're a guy who understands these things better than me. I've been looking at some of the things you put out related to, you know, exactly how gold's going to respond. You and I have the same view on the NFT thing. There's still many a true believer out there about that. But I got to tell you, the worst thing in the world to me is this sudden acknowledgement by the mainstream that, oh, there's inflation. And as you well know, I have said for many years that, you know, first of all, we've been getting squeezed anyway. But now, you know, it got a lot tighter, and the justification of COVID being the reason why it's supposedly tighter. Funny thing, even as the restrictions come off, and even as, the great walkout happened, and even as all these, supply chain issues happen and everything else, the prices are going up, up, up. And
well, if you if the audience and you can remember when Trump was president, many times he would brag about the stock market going up, and he would also say he wanted interest rates to be lowered. And when the stock market crashed, when the virus, you know, hit the world, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to zero on a Sunday. And I remember watching Trump give a speech on that Sunday announcing this news and celebrating it and saying how great it was. And they also started a quantitative easing bond buying operation at that same moment. Now, the stock market had a tremendous rally after it bottomed that March, April. And people were very excited getting into NFTs, crypto. It was mass speculation.
Right.
Because the stock market goes up, but it can only go up fast enough for some people. And they want to buy things that go up faster. Mm-hmm. So people created such instruments. And that's really what the NFTs were, I believe. Just speculative things. Stocks weren't good enough, so they made these. But and we didn't go into like a depression. And many companies would have gone bankrupt if it wasn't for the loans and all these things the government was doing. I mean, the government handed out assistance to people. So there was massive government action in 2020, but to do it, the government went into a huge deficit. But the interest rates to zero, and it stimulates the stock market and financial speculation. Mm-hmm. But eventually, it carries over into real estate, other markets, commodities, and so forth. So interest rates being super low, this is the argument I heard a long time ago from people such as Ron Paul. They would say when interest rates are artificially low, that it's going to create inflation. And I believe there's a lot of truth to that. And so the inflation that we are seeing now, I would say, is partly a result of rates being so low and all these emergency measures. I mean, these emergency measures, there's no doubt a lot of people got excitement 2 years ago when they opened up Robinhood accounts and puts money in there and started to play. In trade, and whether it's stocks or crypto or whatever, it was definitely exciting for millions of people. Right. But this stuff isn't free. You know, the government just can't stimulate and print all this money, and there's no cost to it. And the cost is inflation. And now it's hitting us. And it's not going to go away overnight, because the only way to stop it is to raise rates high enough that it starts contracting economic activity.
Right.
And if they did that overnight, you know, the latest data is that the CPI, consumer price inflation, went up annualized 7%. I mean, since we've been talking about this since September, every month it's a record. Well, this was a new record, 7% over a year, right, from 40 years ago. Now, before an hour ago, I happened to send a friend of mine a text message saying this, the inflation 7%, and a guy who's involved now, and he's constructing some homes, he texted me back and said, it's more like 20-30%.
Yeah. Okay. But here's. Yeah,
but I'm not going to argue with him. I just said, I know, but you know, the government is. You know, I'm just. All I'm doing is comparing the 7% data to, you know, the historic data the government has, it's a record, that's all. But
right. It's a record, but there's more than one factor in play here. This is what the issue is. And also, because they're giving you a mean average of what they say the inflationary curve is, that doesn't mean that every sector is affected equally. He could indeed be seeing 20% increases. That actually makes sense.
Oh, sure.
And also, as you and I have discussed many times, and I saw it acknowledged again, you know, in financial stories over the past couple of days, that, hey, you know, all these buybacks where these companies are buying their own stocks artificially did things. See, look, there's the manipulation of what is happening by the corporate interests who turn around and buy their own stocks, inflate their prices, and I don't even know what to call Elon Musk at this point, but, you know, okay. It's just, these guys do this stuff, and it changes the game, too. And the thing is, to me, there is always in play something which, you know, to me, I recognize from the 80s as the junk bond kind of era, where there's always some sort of a empty asset out there that artificially holds things up for a little while, and it's not usually just one kind of thing, but many kinds of things, and they're usually overvalued, and then we get, you know, what everybody calls a correction at some point, you know, the game is over. I mean, it's weird. This is why I call it a casino.
The thing is, right now, when we, everybody, you, me, everybody, when we think of what's going on in the stock market, and you mentioned Tesla, Elon Musk, typically what people are reacting to and thinking about in their mind is what has happened in the preceding 12 months. Well, I'll just use Tesla as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla went down to under $100 in 2020. And it had a tremendous rally, and by the end of 2020, it was trading at 700. So it went up about 7 times,
mm-hmm.
and it hit 1,200 around Thanksgiving.
Right,
1,200 from 100, less than 100 to 1,200. That's a, you know, huge return, but that's the past, and this stock has come off the high. It's now trading at 830, and most stocks in the stock market have declined tremendously in the past couple months. Most of them are below their 200-day moving average, like 70% mm-hmm. of stocks in the stock market. Tesla's sitting right on it. What is happening is, while these stocks have gone up and done so well up until really this past New Year's, a lot of them peaked out, like Tesla, months ago. Most stocks are actually in bear markets. Right as we're speaking, they're trending down, and that's what's going on. We're actually in, I believe, the first inning, let's say, of a bear market in the stock market. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, they tumbled in January. The NASDAQ had its biggest January decline in, like, ever. And then it rallied, bounced a little bit over, like, 2 weeks, and that bounce is now fading.
Now, look, there are real-world considerations, and then there's the other, okay? And part of the other is also this thing which is now becoming popular and parroted among financial commentators, right? You know, you called it the first inning. Well, you know, in the first inning, they're going to start talking about how they think the pitchers are going to perform and how ready the bullpen is. And it's funny because they try and do a predictive sort of thing, you know, keep you interested. This is what we think is going to happen in the game. What is happening in the financial markets right now, which is weird, is I'm starting to see a signal of, well, you know, if there's actual conflict in Ukraine, this is going to cause energy prices to spike, you know, even more than they already have. We're definitely seeing it at the pump. You're definitely seeing it. Different things are being added to all of your energy bills right now, Mike, right? Across the country, I'm hearing this. Everybody's getting that addition, and they're saying that this could actually spike the entire inflationary curve, which they're calling 7%. I don't think it's right, not in a real world sense. It's higher. Is it as high as some people say it is? I'm not sure, because in certain sectors, like I said, if you're, you know, out having to buy a lot of meat right now, you're looking at 40%. Okay, I mean, from last year, you're looking at 40% of an increase on meats, depending on what they are. If you need to be, like, let's just say you're running a restaurant or something like that, or even you're buying it for your home, you're seeing a serious move on that commodity, so to speak. But anyway, they're saying that, you know, that 7% they're talking about, well, it might turn into 10%, which is very strange to me, because I'm saying to myself, every time there is any sort of conflict, there is always an excuse that energy prices have to go up. And this is despite the release of the strategic reserve. A little bit of strategic reserve was released. Biden gave some lip service to, I'm going to bring the energy costs down. Nothing happened.
Well, the problem with, they're giving you a, when it comes to the financial markets and inflation,
yep,
they are giving you a false narrative.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you the reason why they're doing it. It's very simple.
Cool.
But the reason why it's false, I got to say first, the reason why it's false is because these higher energy prices, this inflation. When I last spoke to you, I think I told you I went to the grocery store and bought some seafood, mm-hmm. and I think I paid 10% more than I did on that purchase than I did 3 weeks ago.
Right.
The preceding 3 weeks. I think it went up 10%. But regardless, this is not anything new. You know, these higher energy prices and higher food prices and higher rent prices, this was going on. It really started a year ago and just simply accelerated throughout all of last year.
Amen.
So
yeah.
This whole Ukraine story that appeared in the media 2 weeks ago is not the cause of all this, because it was already happening. And the whole Ukraine thing's another topic, but that's not even, as you and Larry have,
yeah, we're going to go over that in the next hour. Don't worry. We're going to go over that in the next hour. You know, I assure you, but I'm just saying, yeah, exactly. But, thank you. Go ahead.
But the reason why in the financial media, I would say maybe it's different than the New York Times and CNN.
Yeah.
The financial media being CNBC and all the financial websites out there, for the most part, the mainstream financial websites.
Yeah, but see, the CNNs and the New York Times and everything are going to pick up those stories from the financial
media.
Yeah,
they do. You're right. They don't specialize in it, so, no. they repeat those. You're right.
Right. I mean, literally,
CNBC is a division of NBC, right?
Exactly. So, but even CNN, who isn't partnered with CNBC, will turn around and pick up the CNBC story and run with it.
To really drill into it, it's actually, you know, I'll just drill into it. What it's not, why the narrative, why the narrative is false, and who's actually generating the narrative.
Sure.
Because you're right, I shouldn't actually blame it on CNBC. They're not really the fault of it. They're the delivery mechanism.
You got it.
So what is going on in the financial markets is, it's a bear market. These stocks are declining.
That's it.
And they're not, it doesn't mean every single stock's going to fall, but 90% of them are declining. And the reason why is because they went up so much already, and the higher interest rates that are coming now, they don't have to explode, just going up. Interest rates are going to go up because of this inflation, and the Federal Reserve has said they're going to raise interest rates. They're projecting to raise interest rates from zero.
Right.
You know, interest rates should be zero anyway.
Right.
To 1.5. I mean, by the end of the year. I mean, it's not like it's going even. But the problem is, why that matters so much to the financial markets is that these companies, such as Tesla, Netflix,
right,
just to name two that we've spoken about before, and everyone knows what they are, but they're just examples of a bigger rot.
Mm-hmm.
Companies they have massive debts, and they take on massive debt just to operate. Netflix spends, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head, but it's over $1 billion a year.
Yeah, we kind of went over this. We went over this where it was like, look, they're this much in debt.
The real numbers, but it's a tremendous amount of money that they spend.
Right.
And to do it, they got to borrow money. They take out debt. That's where the interest rate matters, because when the rate of interest goes up, then their expenses go up. And if it goes up too much, they will go belly up. And there will be many companies that will go belly up.
Well, right.
Even if interest rates go up a percentage.
Look, it's real simple, because if you were servicing
completely hot air,
right,
and they're debt zombies.
Well, but that's the thing, is if you're a debt zombie who has to service a debt at 0%, that's one thing. As soon as there's any cost attached to it, you know, again, 1% of many millions of dollars or whatever it is, hundreds of millions, becomes a pretty significant amount. Now that becomes a bill just to service that debt, whereas before, zero was the service fee on that debt pretty much. Or maybe there was a service fee, but it doesn't amount to much. But if you actually have to pay a percentage on borrowing all that money, you know, like the rest of us, right?
And I'll name one that will go bankrupt, likely. I mean,
yeah, but
speak with certainty. I have a car dealer friend who tells me that Carvana is a crazy company, and it doesn't make sense to them.
Right.
And I looked, and they've got tremendous debt, you know, and they lost $500 million
right
in the last 12 months that they reported, and the stock was $375. That stock was under $25 in 2020, and it went to $375, and now it's at $135. So it's already fallen substantially. The stock is like in a death spiral. And there's many stocks like it. This is what's wrong with the stock market. And what's going on, though, is the Robin Hood people, the people that don't they're got in their mind what's happened in the past 12 months, and they're not really yet, for the most part, recognizing how these things have changed.
Well, they had no reason to recognize it up until now.
Well, they will when they lose a lot of money.
Well, you know, when all of a sudden, see, if you and I were running a corner store and we lost $500 at the wrong time, we might be out of business. You know, but these guys, they lose $500 million over a certain amount of time. When you got that much cash flowing in and out, basically, I mean, not physically, because that would be a whole other job in and of itself. But when you've got this kind of currency coming in and out in digital fashion, you can actually do business. It's crazy making to me, because again, if you and I had a brick and mortar store, we don't pay our lease or we don't pay our tax, or we're done. We can't carry that kind of debt.
Here's what these financial channels do.
Yeah,
they will have a guy on that will say, that are smarter than I am.
Okay.
And usually these guys are really old too, and they've been doing, you know, this forever, and they're like hedge fund managers and billionaires or whatever. And they will say these sort of things and lay all this out, and they'll have like one person a month do this. And then what'll happen is websites like mine or Zero Hedge, let's say, alternative media sites, I don't know what you want to call them.
Sure.
We will make note of that and say, look, listen to this guy. Look what he's saying. I mentioned a few of these people on your show in the past.
Yep.
Ray Dalio is one. There's a half a dozen of these people that they will trout on the TV.
Right.
But what happens is they appear once.
Yep.
And then the rest of every other damn segment they air is someone that's telling you something else. So
yeah, the rest of the week, right? You get an hour of that guy.
And what has been going on the rest of the week, 2 weeks, is There's inflation because of Putin and Ukraine. The stock market's falling because of Putin and Ukraine. But the stock market's up today. Maybe there's going to be peace in Russia.
Right.
And really, it's just up because it can't fall every day, and some days it's got to go up and whatever.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know? So, you know, and that's the funny thing is it's not just about the financial markets, again, like your website. But I mean, that is a microcosm of what goes on in the rest of the news media, where you have to consider the delivery mechanism and exactly the point they're trying to make. Every once in a while, they do allow a talking head on who maybe gets some things right. But then the rest of the week, it's about hyping up certain things in order to create a narrative.
Here's why on the financial media, and then we could maybe we'll spill this over into other parts.
That's where I was going, yeah.
Why the lies? Why won't they just tell you the truth? Why? It's very simple. With the financial media, it's the advertisers. And the Rolodex of people they call on, the advertisers are stock brokerage firms like Robinhood, E-Trade, Ameritrade, or investment advisory firms. And all these companies, they want you to put your money in the stock market and either hold it as an investment so they'll make fees off your money,
right,
or open up a brokerage account and trade to try to get rich. Now, they need you in the stock market. Want you in the stock market, and they need you to believe in it.
One thing about this, though, between that and the fact that other advertisers, because not even these financial channels all have financial type advertisers, right? Some of them have others, and they're big corporate interests, huge. And so during the course of, even if, say, Johnson & Johnson's stock is tanking, they don't want to bring it up because that's one of their sponsors. And, you know, even as silly as something like potato chips, if they're made by the right corporate interest, they don't want to attack, you know, Heinz or whoever it is that's, that big massive company that now encompasses Pepsi and Doritos and all those companies. They don't want to bash their sponsors either. So they don't say that the value's fallen. They don't talk about the companies being sued. They don't talk about, see what I mean? So there's two different things happening here. One, there is the financial game. Yes, stay invested, because if we do anything that really sounds an alarm significantly and don't tell you, don't worry, it's going to get hot. There's some other pressures happening. But as soon as that clears up, everything's going to be great again. And everything's great now if you just can be smart about it and you can be a good bear, right? They do that because, like you said, they got all those financial sponsors. But then even the ancillary, the other sponsors, they don't want to mess with the big pharma company. They don't want to mess with the big food company, fast food, whatever it is they're running. They don't want to give any sort of shade to their stocks either, right? It's a financial decision. It's a business model decision. They're handcuffed in this way automatically because you don't bash your sponsors, right? So, I mean, it's just, it works all the way around on this. And I'm just saying that's another thing to keep note of when you're taking a look at some of these other media companies that are supposed to be giving you information. A lot of times they can't really talk about, you know, what happened because AT&T had a problem. Their stock is falling or whatever. That might be their parent company. So they don't want to bring that up. And who knows how much commercial revenue is coming from them. They don't bash that, because it's not useful to do so. You don't want to drive down the stock. You don't want to put a bad spin on the company. So, hey, let's skip this, even though, you know, Johnson & Johnson gave people baby powder and they're still litigating this and trying to get away with it and everything else, the cancer-causing stuff. But they don't want, you know, but maybe they got a Johnson & Johnson shampoo ad. Maybe they got a new drug that Johnson & Johnson has a huge interest in. You know, if you feel as though your heart could use this thing, and oh, by the way, it gives you a heart attack and 80 other symptoms that I'm going to read really fast. You know, they don't want to bash those companies, do they? So this is a very simple equation. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. So therefore, judge the information and remember who's paying for it, because it might have something to do with the content. Right or wrong, Mike?
No, it basically is how it works. And then the guests that they do put on there, on these financial channels, almost all of them are running a fund. and these, like a mutual fund or some sort of fund, in which their entire job is to buy stocks. Well, if your job is to buy stocks and own them all the time, you're going to convince yourself that this is a good thing to do and it's going to work out. Mm-hmm. So they've got people who are invested literally with their entire livelihood. It's not just someone that's got a brokerage account. This is their job, you know,
right,
is to do these things. And they convince themselves that these to believe it's going to go up all the time is the right thing to do. Right. So they look for any reason the market is down is a temporary one that's going to go away. Right. Now, I don't think the market's going to fall forever. You know, I think it could fall for 12 months. I don't know. Maybe 2 years. I don't know. Right. But these people can't accept the idea that it could fall for a week.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that bad. You know, it's got to be peace. The market's falling because last week they were saying the market's falling because Putin is going to invade Ukraine on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Well, on Tuesday, the market goes up and they say, oh, he's not going to invade. Right. And now it went down again pretty bad. And now they're saying, oh, he's going to invade in a couple days. I mean, come on.
Well, past 2 years, too, the other thing is the default where, you know, again, no matter what you think of it, COVID is now the default. So there's no headline story for why the market's falling. Now the geniuses are going to tell you, well, it's falling because of COVID. You know, and oh, it's not COVID today, but it's COVID from 6 months ago. And, you know, we're now feeling it. And I'm like, you know what? You guys are just looking for something to fit in to give as a reason as opposed to actually examining what the mechanism is that's squeezing things. And the funny part, again, is that the market is not really realistically connected to a lot of us, you know, directly. I mean, it will affect us, but it's not connected to us directly. It's not a casino everybody pays to get into. I'm sorry. It just isn't. So, you know, it's a very weird thing. But, you know, we've gone through half of the time that I have allotted for you because we started a little late, guys. I didn't mean to go this deep into this, it's necessary.
I'll just say this to kind of in the financial markets discussion is I told this friend of mine I was talking to earlier that I believe right now, at this moment, the two best things anyone could invest in is either gold or real estate. And the problem with real estate is you got to have money to buy real estate properties. You can't be heavily in debt. You got to get loans from the bank and do all this stuff. I'm too lazy to get involved in it. So gold and silver or the stock market, it's just it's over.
Well, gold is not cheap for most of us either, but it's a little cheaper than property. Silver, something. Yeah, and this is the default position when, guess what? Things are about to get rough. It's always a good backup to get into, especially the physical stuff, where, you know, you own something, you might be able to cash in.
Well, honestly, with gold and silver, I don't know. I was looking at both of them.
Yeah.
And they both are the same distance away from the recent lows they made in December. And really, when they go up, silver has more upside. So actually, if I was going to say which one is a better investment, silver is, for the risk to reward, it actually would be silver.
Yeah, and it's also more accessible to more people. So just saying. Okay, it just is. Incrementally, you can get involved in silver a lot easier. I mean, I don't know what the gold spot price is today for an ounce, but if you were to buy a physical ounce of gold, it's still a lot of ounces of silver to get there.
Well, today it's $1,900, and silver's about $24.
Yeah, which, you know, not bad. Now, I'm wondering if we're going to see a spike there, because, again, as we're watching real estate prices go up, I really do see them as coupled together. They do travel in the same trajectory a lot of times, don't they? So, definitely. By the way, I will accept donations of silver coins if anybody has any that they want to part with. I'm just saying, I would love to have a backup supply of silver in these times, and I would advise others to do the same. Anyways, so Mike, but there's other things going on too, and I want to get to those as well.
I thought what I might make start. I've done this before. I was like, well, what's something to talk about with you? And I should just go back at some of the top headlines and stories that I've seen this week. And I'm going to, the first one is something most people haven't heard of. I may have mentioned it to you, but I mentioned it to friends of mine. No one listens to me, so I'll just try again.
Okay.
And I just want to recommend something. That's a TV show I watched.
Okay, sure.
It's on HBO. It's the biggest hit in Italy. Around, you know, it's called Gomorra, and it's just ended. It's a 5-season show about the Italian mafia. It's really good. I mean, people 2 years ago, this Game of Thrones thing was huge in the United States and maybe around the world, and I enjoyed watching it. But after 2 years have gone by, I would say I would not recommend anyone watch that. You know, I know you've seen The Sopranos, I'd say, you know, you want to watch a great TV show, I'd put The Sopranos on the list.
Yeah,
I wouldn't put Game of Thrones on the list,
right?
Because that last season was so bad, it just ruined the whole. You got to have a good ending, you know, to have a good story. Right. Sopranos ended good.
It was a well fleshed out. I mean, you got full story arcs out of different characters. You had, you know, a lot of things going on. I'll tell you what's funny is a comedy they have going, and I haven't watched Gomorra yet, so I'm waiting to hear what you have to say about it. But among the HBO properties, The Righteous Gemstones is pretty funny. Just saying. I'm enjoying that one on occasion. I'm a little behind on it, but that one is a great thing if you want comedy. But this Gomorra show, yeah, tell me about it. I mean,
It's filmed in Naples, and it's interesting when you see, you know, if I think about how is this different from, say, The Wire, which is, did you ever see The Wire?
Oh yeah, well, The Wire was another, you know, well written series, nitty gritty kind of thing, though, you know, about the drug game basically in Baltimore and that area,
right? And I really like that show too, because I, you know, been to Baltimore and lived near it when I was a little kid, but it was one of my favorite shows too. But that's a whole other show to talk about. But
sure.
I'm trying to think about the mob genre. You know, how is The Sopranos different than The Godfather? You know, The Godfather really was the first big mafia thing. And The Sopranos, when it came out in the 90s, these shows are kind of a testament, as everything else is, to the times they're made in.
Right.
And The Godfather came out in the 1970s as the Vietnam War and the Nixon era. And I've seen interviews of Francis Ford Coppola say something like he thought the American Empire, the United States, was very arrogant, and the Michael Corleone character in some elements, in some of the scenes,
right,
was sort of an example of that. He said something to that effect, like when they have the scenes of him being in the Congress and they're having some sort of congressional hearing, and he gets out of it.
Well, yeah, yeah. No, there is a representation in Coppola's work there that is very much...
Of course, the Cuba angle, you know,
Cuba... But all that stuff is born out of its time, you're right. Previous to that, though, let's not forget that there were, you know, gangster films and everything before that. But they were very
Untouchables, the
yeah, all that stuff. It was very
Scarface from the 30s.
You got it. You know, the Edward G. Robinson kind of stuff. And yeah, that was very superficial. It got more personalized as some, as truthfully, as some Italians started to say, look, let's show that there's actually a culture here. Let's show that there's a background to this. You know, that they're living in the same world. It's not just, you know, here's the gangster, here's Al Capone, here's Bugsy. Hey, see, but I'm here to do this.
The thing about The Godfather, it came out the same time, like the same time the Parallax View came out.
Oh, yeah.
Some of these type of conspiracy, let's say, movies. And The Godfather was, they're conspiring, and you're like in the room with them. Right. So you're in an insider in the conspiracy.
Well, it runs the gamut, because you get to see what, you know, what is the attitude of the drug business in the cities.
Yeah.
You get to see, you know, in the later movie, you get the whole story arc about the Pope and the Vatican Bank scandal, which, again, is sort of drawn from real life. You got the congressional thing where, obviously, there was the whole, what was it, the McClellan Commission. It's meant to echo that. Regarding, you know, no, Senator, you know, and I was never part of this or that. And the other guy who comes out, what was it, Valachi, who starts going, yeah, they prick your finger, yeah, and they do the whole thing. And you see that through Willie Cheechy in the movie. You see the very slick sort of thing that happens, and then they end up with an informant, you know, and tell, what is it, Frankie Five Angels there, Pentangeli, that, you know, look, you might want to consider that at some point the Roman emperors used to let somebody who tried to lead a coup go ahead and kill themselves, and that way their families wouldn't have to be affected. You know what I mean? And then that whole scenario, and it's very interesting. A lot of stuff is contained in there, a lot of metaphorical things. And like you said, it's part of the zeitgeist that was in the early 70s, but also Coppola's personal vision, along with Puzo, obviously, who wrote it, of you know, some Italian-American culture as well. There was a lot of cultural things in there that made it more personal. It was much less superficial than just the headline-grabbing, you know, here's the gangster in the great suit and the tough guy, and, see, you know. It went well beyond what was previous in the genre. And The Sopranos, again, later on, is an evolution over a much longer time period, over six seasons or seven, depending on how you view it. You get a insider's point of view on what it's like now. Okay, we get the idea this might have been what it was like for a guy in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. You know, new immigrant who comes here has to scratch and struggle. And then what happens when you hand it over to the next generation? Well, a couple generations down the line, you might indeed get a guy like Tony Soprano who's got these other problems. You know what I mean? Who's got the, you know, the modern suburbia stupidity going on. Plus, he's a gangster. You know, and that, again, spoke to the time period. And when it's well done,
well,
it's well done.
Well, it was the post-9/11 time period, well, or right around 9/11. Actually.
Initially, it was before 9/11, and then 9/11 happened, and that even became part of the show.
Yeah.
You know, not just the fact that they wind up removing the towers from the opening and all that kind of stuff in order to not, you know, keep reliving it in the opening scenes of The Sopranos. They actually digitally removed the Twin Towers and stuff like this. There's a whole thing there. And a bunch of story arcs, in fact, contained in that series where they have, you know, they were working with some Arab guys. And these guys, you know, they were partying and everything, and maybe now they're fundamentalists, and who knows what's going on there. And even the gangster wants to work with the FBI and Homeland Security to, because, you know, look, I'm a criminal and everything, but how about if I help you out a little? Because I care about this country too, which is that weird duality that does exist in, among Italian businessmen, where you have, you know, situations like that. And if you know about Lucky Luciano and what went on during World War II and the defense of the ports, and quite frankly, the U.S. government basically got help from the gangsters to protect the ports in New York. And, you know, it's one of those disputed things in history, but it's becoming a little more well-known now. Plus the invasion of Italy via Sicily might have had a little help there, too. those guys, you know, with the OSS and all. Just saying. There is an interesting thing that's laid out there. Now, this Gamora show, I got to be honest with you, I haven't checked it out. I just did not know much about it, and nobody's brought it to my attention. So,
no, I'm telling you, this is one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Nice.
I mean, it's that good. That's why I keep telling people to watch it. So, I mean, people like Breaking Bad. You know, it's on that level. You know,
really.
But the filming, the music, the acting, it's like a movie. You
nice.
Know, the production quality, but that, you know, it's better. I don't really like modern day movies, so I would say it's as entertaining and whatever as Breaking Bad is.
Okay.
But it's got one similarity with The Wire, is that it's filmed in a gritty kind of area, you
Good.
Know, where it's based on a novel that an investigative reporter wrote about this criminal mafia running Naples. And so some of the plot, subplots of the thing come from real events, particularly in the first season, first maybe two seasons. The main character in the first season is an older, is the head of a mafia family, mm-hmm. and he can see that his empire is under threat, and he has a son that, he has an only child that's not fit to take his place, put it that way.
Okay.
And he's under siege, and, you know, from younger people, younger gangsters coming up, and that's the one of the main story arcs of the first season. And but part of the thing about the show is, while, you know, it has a distinctive feel of the place, the cinematography,
right,
which is what The Wire, I think, had brought people, you know, made Baltimore and the ghetto of Baltimore look like a, you know, just an interesting place, right, to film. This does the same thing, and it's filmed in the same, you know, in the areas where these crimes took place and drug dealing and this and that. But it shows you, on one hand, how this criminal organization operates from the very top to the very bottom, which is kind of what The Wire tried to do.
Right.
But I think this does it better as far as showing you how the mafia operates.
I'll be anxious to see how true that is, because
the thing about it, though, is it is in tune, I think, with the way we feel today. It's different than The Sopranos. On one hand, it you know, I watched the Star Trek thing, Discovery, I think it's called.
Right.
I didn't watch the newest season, but that show is got gay characters in it, and, you know, something that's like a transgender person, I guess.
Yes.
One of the main characters is black. She's the captain, which that doesn't. The other stuff, though, the way they present it, it's almost too much. I don't know what the word is for it, but
see, it's funny. I didn't take it that way, and usually I'm disturbed by this, but.
Well, it's too deliberate. That's the word I'm trying to.
No, I understand. You know, when they force.
It's too deliberate.
Right.
With this Gamora thing,
yeah,
they have a few subplots that deal with a cross-dresser. I don't know even what the right terms are. A cross-dresser person. And there's some gay people, but none of it is ever, you know, it's just that. It's like Uhura in Star Trek. So what? You know what I mean?
No,
it's
not, I got you. I got you. I got to tell you that I didn't feel as though it was forced with Discovery, but I do know what you mean by.
Well, maybe I just don't like the actors.
It could be that too. Listen, I don't like the main actor.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying. All I'm trying to say is that this show has some of that in it. It's. No one would even notice it, And that's part of the trend of today. That's the only thing I'm saying.
Yeah.
A little bit part of our culture at the moment. But what's more important is this show has a theme to it, or implied throughout it, that these people, whereas the Sopranos, Tony Soprano would say things like, "We've seen the best there is," you know, as far as America and
right.
The way he feels about culture. This show, one of the musical scores of it is called "Doomed to Live." So it's like we're all fated to live out in a time where things could be ending in doom, or fatalistic or something.
Well, see, but to me, the Soprano story is that too, where he sees the decline of the culture.
Well, the difference is he sees the decline happening. In this, the decline's already happened.
Oh, okay. So this is
that's. You know, no one says that in the show, but the Naples area that they're living in, like Baltimore is presented, has already declined. You know, so they're living out, doing all this stuff,
right? But
in a place that's completely declined. The difference with the Wire is they'll say this over and over again. You know, they refer to the decline of Baltimore, all the different characters. No one ever actually does that in this. It's just the background of the show.
Well, I haven't seen it yet, but I would argue with you that in The Sopranos, yeah, it's already after the fall as well, because everybody who winds up taking over positions of authority, these are not the A-team. They're just not the A-team. The guys who are running New York, they're struggling with each other. It's a time of chaos.
What's different, though, is this show has a more like fatalistic thing to it with the characters.
I
don't think The Sopranos does so much.
I think you forgot how many of those characters didn't make it out alive. You know what I mean? It's because, and the truth is, it's all about there's no longer honor. There's no longer, you know, the code. Everybody's flipping on everybody.
Right,
This has definitely come down in that culture, and also the world around him is changing. He doesn't like that. You know, it might be a little more dated. Because, you know, he's upset that his daughter's dating a black guy and this kind of thing, which is, you know, weird because, honestly, a whole commentary emerges there where, you know, the daughter says, well, you know, what do you mean? What's his problem? And the mother says, you know, he came from a different time and a different place. And she goes, what, New Jersey? This century? What's going on here? You know, like, he's not adjusting to the time either. It's already fallen. Even he himself is a bad example of a guy trying to run this organization, right? He is not the best of the best. Nobody is anymore because there is no, you know what I mean? We'd like to go back to the old days because all of this is already falling apart. And at the end of it, quite honestly, the New Jersey faction that you've been following throughout the show is destroyed. And much due to their own self-destructive behaviors. And, you know, it wasn't functioning right to begin with. I mean, nobody got as rich as they should have. Nobody was... It's a whole thing. So I can't wait to see what Gamora looks like. I'm sure I'll find it interesting. And it's something to see it from the Italian side, because that's not always shown. You usually get, you know, here's the American guy. And you can almost see the metaphor coming a mile away. So I want to see what it's like. And they might introduce some of this, you know, more modern considerations when it comes to being politically correct or multiculturalism. That might happen. But again, it would be a product of its time. And this thing is still in production now, or is it done as a show?
It's done. I just see that's why I can recommend it, because I've watched the whole thing, 5 seasons.
Okay.
And the last season was good, and it had a good ending. You know, it wasn't a disaster like Game of Thrones.
Oh, well, what are you going to do there? But no, this Discovery thing, I urge you to stick with it because
I will. I'm not. When I say that, I'm not saying it's a horrible show. I'm just, you know, nitpicking or whatever.
Well, it's definitely different.
I watched Discovery right before I watched this. The third season of Discovery, and honestly, to me, it's not really special. It's just whatever. It's just like a. It's exciting to me is watching a. superhero show or something.
All right, look, that's cool, but we all have our own ways of looking at this. Meanwhile,
yeah, I like Deep Space Nine better.
Okay, that's cool. See, now to me, that one got a little boring after a while. I mean, I got to be honest, it was longer
and had its yeah, they're different. It's different.
It had lulls that.
Yeah, it had lulls in it. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah,
that's what it had. Long lulls.
Right, and I lost my patience with it. To be honest with you, I mean,
no, I understand that.
You know, but look again. There's a lot of different ways to look at this. And with the last couple of minutes here, because we're going just a little over the hour, because we started a little late. Thing is, you know, we wind up covering the financial markets, and some TV shows. You never know what you're going to get, but anything else you want to throw in on your way out the door here, feel free, because I know you had some other stuff in mind, but we wound up bogged down in, well, first of all, the real world, and then the world of entertainment. So, fair enough in my mind. Mike Swanson over at WallStreetWindow.com, in case I forget to remind everybody when we go to break, you know, go be in the know at WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street, but you can learn about a lot of stuff. And indeed, you can also learn from Mike's books. He has authored two of them of great interest to me, but he's authored many others, including A History of Danville, Virginia, some financial books and stuff like that. But the two that I focus on are The War State and Why the Vietnam War, which is just the first in a planned series on the Vietnam War. Let's see where that goes in the future. But anyway, Mike, all that having been said, anything else you want to toss in here with the last, I don't know, three, 4 minutes, something like that?
Well, one other story that's happening, and because we talked about it last time, I'll just bring it up.
Sure.
You know, when something is crumbling, you rebrand it or try to. And we talked about how Facebook, you know, changed its name to this metaverse thing, and they're going beyond that. Tuesday, Zuckerberg held a meeting by Zoom, of course, for all employees, and he said that from now on they won't be called employees. He's going to call them metamates.
Metamates?
Yeah, everyone at Facebook. They're supposed to refer to themselves as metamates. And he had a bunch of slides about the corporate slogan. It used to be move fast and break things. Mm-hmm. Now it's move fast. And now he added another word to it, move fast together. All metamates united. I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
I don't want to tell you what that actually sounds like to my ear, Mike. You know, metabates.
I know what it sounds like.
That's
what they're saying.
Okay,
they're
just, saying. Yeah, and do that together. Okay. No.
All I say is I'm glad I don't work there. And reason I'm bringing this up is if you happen to work there and you're listening to this show and you got things you think people need to know about, tell us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Look, I am more than happy to feel like tell me about what's going on. If you are a metamate, by all means, let us know.
If you want to get out of there, let us know.
Let us know what that's like. You know, we will protect your identity if need be. Just saying, I'd be more than happy to explore that strange new fake world, and see where that. There's a whole bunch of statements I now don't want to make because I'm thinking about group metabation. And it's just not my favorite topic, guys. I don't know if I can go there. And Mark Zuckerberg continues to outdo himself with his creepy, creepy concepts.
Well, this is I'm reading this in the Washington Post, right?
Yeah.
And it said that they announced this. They have a chief technology officer.
Okay.
And he made a tweet. And the tweet said, Meta. Metamates. Me. And then he explained to the Washington Post that he was referring to a phrase used by Instagram, which is a ripoff of a naval phrase that he says called shipmate self.
Oh, boy.
So this is the stuff that they pay people millions of dollars to come up with.
You know what? Yeah, it is something that they pay a lot of a lot of people get paid money to come up with these concepts. But one thing I will tell you that's not creepy or not bizarre is WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go over there. Get informed. Sign up for the mailing list. Follow Mike Swanson. Read his books. Oh, my God, Mike. That's just a great way to end an hour. In the next hour, we'll be talking to Larry Hancock, and I guess Ukraine is going to be in our crosshairs. Oh, did I just say that? I think I did. Anyway, thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Good talking with you.
Absolutely. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Revelation through conversation.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to the Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical.
Uncle, I'll bet you remember the time when Benjamin Fulford said that the Asian Secret Society was going to dispatch ninjas to take out the Illuminati to change the entire world for the better.
That is never going to happen. That never did.
It never did it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, because there's a lot of false promises.
Fools? I can't say one.
We better not say and be polite, but there are no false promises at the Ocelli.com radio network.
That's exactly it. Not. It's truth, the point, right to the point. And this is what I like. Straight to the point.
Ocelli.
It's Ocelli.com.
Listen now.
Listen now.
Ocelli.com.
Learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all powerful to people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media. Chuck Ocelli.
The second hour of the Ocelli Effect continues now at Ocelli.com. But, of course, you could be listening some other time, some other place. And if you are hearing us on the live stream, we will go over the hour and complete our two-hour mission tonight. But we started a little late. If you're hearing the podcast, you don't know what I'm talking about. You don't care. So, anyway, during the break, you might have heard, if you didn't skip it, you might have heard a book commercial for In Denial. That's not what we're talking about tonight, but we are talking to that author, Larry Hancock. And, of course, I'll give you the links in the show notes. Go follow Larry's work. Take a look at the array of books that he's written. Many of them actually physically, personally on my bookshelf, which I'll be getting to the bookshelf presentation sometime soon. If I can't stop juggling everything else, we'll get there. But be talking to you about a bunch of things on that bookshelf. From someone would have talked to shadow warfare to surprise attack to, geez, maybe even the topic of tonight's discussion, creating chaos. But is it chaos? And is it a wider spectrum of things we might have to discuss? Oh, and by the way, I'm also hoping that we'll feature a little something with Larry sometime in the near future called Unidentified once again. But, yeah, check out his work, learn about it, because it is important and well-written. Meanwhile, yeah, unfortunately, I have to press on Larry about the Ukraine slash Russia slash Putin situation, because it's still happening. And now it's happening in a strange way, propaganda-wise. I mean, what we're looking at coming from the Western media. I've actually gotten to see a little bit from some Ukrainian media figures who are finally being integrated into conversations. I guess they heard me when I said, you know, what are you going to do? Keep sticking a correspondent in a hotel room? They seem to have changed that up, sent out Clarissa Ward, who I have mixed feelings about, and things like that. She's out there in a flak jacket and a helmet, and she wants to show you the hole that was blown into a kindergarten, of course, recently. And all of that's happening. Plus, oh, somebody made a statement to the UN today. A lot to sort out. Larry Hancock, before I run out of time just trying to think out loud about all this, first off, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing okay, Chuck. It's still cold in Oklahoma and windy, but I'm inside, so we're good.
Well, it's a good thing, and I'm glad you're safe, you know, not just for selfish reasons that I could use your mind to help me get through this very interesting time we're looking at here. Again, you know, looking at the history, you can often determine what the future might hold. Huh. And I even saw the recent points coming up from very limited individuals who are allegedly, you know, able to parse out all of what this actually means. The different former military general, former CIA guy, that they bring on all these networks to talk about this stuff. And meanwhile, all you had to do was listen to Larry Hancock, I don't know, a long time ago or a couple of weeks ago, and you probably got a better analysis than you do from these alleged former professionals who are in the business of dealing with this. Sorry, Larry, I'm going to say it, even if you're not, but where are we at today with this? I mean, there's a lot coming out, and I know that the discussions about the energy and what it is Germany's role might become here, you know, new chancellor visiting with Putin, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. Enough out of me, Larry. There's a lot coming at us fast and furious. So where should we begin with where we're at today, Larry?
Well, I think what we may want to begin with the fact that perhaps in a surprising or not surprising, Mr. Putin has become quite predictable, which, as you and I talked last time, you know, if you listen to what the man said, he tells you the truth. He tells you what he's going to do. And I guess because they're not used to that from other senior leaders, you know, it doesn't get the traction that might. Putin actually tells you what he's going to do and has for decades now. Going back to about 2002, 2004, if you just follow his statements, you knew what was coming. Predictability is, you know, you might think that that was a good thing. Unfortunately, in the current situation, it may not be so good because he's doing the same things he's done before. We know how that turned out. He's using the same tactics that he's used before. They worked for him. They may not work now. I'm a little bit surprised because Putin seems to be running an open playbook, which is not, you know, he's more sophisticated. People are talking about how many options he has now, but really, quite frankly, I'm not seeing it other than military options. And that's not really a lot of options when you get down to just how are you going to use your forces.
I'm beginning
to wonder if Mr. Putin is as altogether as he used to be. I don't know. Did you happen to see him during the introduction to the Olympics, Chuck?
Well, yeah, but before we get to exactly how together he is, I have another question here that you bring up, because indeed there is a more transparent sort of playbook here. And like you said, it does seem as though we are boiling it down to just, you know, what are the military options? Now, I'm not sure if that's Western media's spin or if that's really what's happening. It's questionable, because, you know, I also will never underestimate the idea that this guy could be playing one thing in public and doing an entirely different operation privately. I think there's no time like the present in order to change your pattern to really surprise people. So I would say, you know, be on the ready for whatever's going to happen here. But what's fascinating to me is the responses now. Because, look, if we look back at 2014 and how the U.S. Administration responded, virtually nothing. And, of course, we talked about the virtual zero response seemingly from around the world regarding Georgia. And the Crimea narrative that I'm not so convinced was true, that this was a natural order of things that just came into being, you know. There's a lot of weird things going on here, and it seems like even Biden is playing more openly with making accusations that would not normally be floated in public. I mean, he's making them through Blinken and through his own statements for sure. But I mean, there is a weirdness going on in the public communication, which, again, I always state, is not necessarily as advertised. You know, telling them that we see you doing things is not necessarily to just be transparent and truthful with the public. It could be a strategy. And making claims that you see things that are going on that maybe aren't, and the other side knows that, means that now they have other things to consider. I mean, I liked that during Blinken's statement in the UN today, that he actually mentions, oh, I know that I'm not, I got to address the fact that somebody has sat here at the UN before and made a statement maybe that, well, all I'm going to say is I wasn't trying to start a war here today. And to me, that was like, hello, Colin Powell. You know, hello, this is not a justification for us to make an aggressive move. As in, i.e., what? The Iraq situation. A different level of communication could be going on here. Not justifying something on the world stage so that when you take action later, look, this is what we knew, this is what we had in hand, but something else happening. What are your thoughts on that? Because I would say that the U.S. responses to this odd open playbook are also unusual. And then, yeah, by all means, go in the direction you were going in. I'll shut up because I need to learn here what's happening. Please. Well,
I think two things. I think they're unusual in that we have far more information than we have in the past because this has been going on so long. I mean, not only it is a repetition of something that's occurred before, but the movement of the forces, this... Putin has moved 60% of his entire military capability, including large formations all the way from the east to the west. And he's done this. I mean, this takes railroad trains and it's taken a long time. So Nobody is being caught by surprise anymore. He's being very overt. It's very visible. I will say, Chuck, one of the big things that's different, if you look in the right places, so much intelligence is now available from commercial satellites, which have extremely high resolution. There's just no doubt about those Russian military movements. There's no doubt about where they are around the borders, what formations are where. The other thing that's really driving him nuts is he may be able to control his own troops, but I'm seeing constant feeds of cell phone videos from folks in Belarus. And I mean, it may not be the Russian soldiers photographing themselves, but you're seeing troop movements mm-hmm. on the ground. And that's one thing you really can't control. So I think the U.S. and the West is in a position of knowing a lot more. The first time when Putin moved into Crimea, when he moved into Ukraine before, he did it much more covertly. He did it in a much less obvious, brutal fashion. You know, the classic thing was suddenly you had, you know, 10,000 Russian military in East Ukraine, and eventually he had to acknowledge that they'd infiltrated them. But his statement to the press was, well, yeah, there were just a lot of Russian troops on vacation. This is not like that. So I think the U.S. and administration, I won't say they're scared, but he's become so predictable and so open. It's not the game that he was playing before. So that's changed, and it's reduced his options. There's absolutely no way before, if you go back to the roots of all this in 2004, 2005, when he first became obsessed with Ukraine because he campaigned there himself and lost, he was playing carrot and stick with Europe, using gas as he wanted to be a strategic partner, and he was going to offer them tremendously cheap gas to gain influence, especially in Germany and Italy. He was going to establish the biggest domestic pipeline distribution network in the world with Gazprom. And he was having dinner meetings and business meetings and being charming. Now, that ended up in him actually cutting gas to Western Europe for about 5-10 days, and just to demonstrate to Ukraine that he could do it. And everybody just kind of went, well, okay, it was about Ukraine. It's not about us. Now they know that he could be playing that lever again, but he's not. Everything is a threat, basically. And that's changed the context, because the other part of it, Chuck, is I don't know what anybody feels that he really has to gain. Putin's always been good at leveraging options for gain. I've yet to see what this is going to gain him. If he moves, it's going to hurt him economically. It's going to hurt him as far as being the supplier of Europe that he wants to be, especially. And there's an interesting article out today that with some of the new gas fields off of Israel and the Mediterranean, that sort of thing, he may not have the influence long term that he's had up to now. So I guess to me, he's moved into more of a less sophisticated, more kind of brute force, roguish position with no obvious positive outcome. Are you seeing something differently?
Well, I'm curious as to whether we're just seeing, trying to ignore the obvious, thinking that, you know, it's got to be, maybe it's just simply that he wants the reunification one way or another, and this is just leverage to get there. Because, you know, I heard some of these other analysts go into, well, you know, it seems like Biden sort of signaled that he's going to try and convince the European countries that are reliant on Russian energy to get in line here and do the right thing for NATO, and they don't seem to be all that receptive to it. So I think that's off the table as far as being able to leverage Putin back at this point. And maybe it's just as simple as picking up the territory.
I think that's a misjudgment. I don't think they have all the facts.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that it's a complete look at it. What I'm saying is this is what's being presented, and I'm just curious as to whether maybe it is just as simple as, no, this belongs in the Russian Federation, and we're going to take it. One way or another, we're going to find a way. I mean, even claiming that, Ukrainian forces are being aggressive with them, also reports out of Russian media that are making it sound like, you know what, there are missiles that are in the Ukraine pointed at Moscow that can be here in a matter of minutes, and they are literally a threat. And, you know, like actually playing as if this is a defensive, necessary movement to defend himself. And that's come out of Russian media. So, you know, I'm not saying that any of these narratives are the real deal. I'm just curious if we're overthinking it, and maybe it is just about reconstituting, basically fill in the blank. Ukraine is a blank to him that really should belong to Russia in his mind. Ukrainians don't seem to agree, but at least not on the majority. Despite this whole thing about, you know, there are separatists who are Russian sympathizers, and there's that whole thing. I'm not saying that it's a quick answer here, but then again, could it just boil down to the desire to reclaim that territory?
I think that's right. I totally agree with you. That's why, and I think that's probably what is the more frightening. I would coin a term like cultural imperialism or cultural nationalism.
Okay.
I do think that Putin has mentally moved back to a position of that being his motive, that literally it's somewhat, I hate to say this, I don't make analogies because everybody gets beaten up for it, but mm-hmm. I mean, starting back to the roots of World War II, starting with Hitler seizing German provinces and German-speaking territory to expand to a greater Germany. That was cultural. It had to do with language. It had to do with, ethnic roots. Mm-hmm. And that sounds, if you listen to Putin, what he's talking about now, as he has been for some years in saying that certainly Eastern Ukraine really isn't a nation. Ukraine always was Russian, and it's not right that it's not part of Russia. And mm-hmm. that's not, that's pretty old school thinking, and that's where wars really do get started, when you start claiming other people as being part of you, which is what he's doing. Well, so I would agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, and, to draw an odd parallel.
That's not classic Putin. That is not geopolitics.
Well,
that's not making Russia a dominant power in the world. That's just making a greater Russia.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing, is usually it's more sophisticated, and that may indeed be part of the agenda. But it's not the thing that's right up front, building the business, so to speak, the energy business and things like this were the upfront agenda, right? And then underneath that used to be this kind of thing. I mean, I'm like drawing a parallel in my mind. I can't help it. Excuse me, just like you did, because, Austria, right? When Hitler moves into Austria, it was kind of, ethnically, this is really Germany, and some other moves that were made there where it was like, this is really should be part of Germany already. It's similar in that way. And there were the cultural justifications. Look, we have a linguistic link. We have cultural links. And all we got to do here is really accept that, and again, they tried to draw this parallel with Hussein, right, where he's going and taking Kuwait. And realistically, at some point, he's not all wrong. Kuwait belonging to Iraq would actually make some sense. But, again, it depends on where you go in the history. Much as I was educated by, my Ukrainian guests about the fact that, look, this is a much longer history, and there is a memory here, a cultural memory among Ukrainians who are indeed separate from Russians, even though they do speak Russian in a lot of places, and things like this. They also speak Ukrainian, and there is a separate culture, and yet there is this idea among people who don't necessarily know the history that, that's just, that was always part of either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. It didn't matter. It was always just one of those things that was part of it, right? Not necessarily true, number one. And number two, maybe the Western world just doesn't see the difference between, Ukrainian is, so I get it, but it's weird to see this being the upfront, almost like if you really tear away a lot of the propaganda on both sides, you get down to cost-benefit analysis, and I keep coming back to, is this just about, I want that territory? And that's it, and that's how he sees it. It's a territory that should belong to his greater Russia, his Russian Federation, his rebuilding, right, of what he believes is rightfully part of the Russian sphere of influence. And that Russian sphere of influence has some real 3D world assets. And one of them, in his mind, should be Ukraine. And is it just that simple? If it is, it's an odd way of going about it. Because there's a bit of cat and mouse and waiting for justifications and, counter recriminations here on the, international stage. When it comes to diplomacy, it's getting strange. They're, ejecting different diplomats and all this kind of stuff. And then, like I said, even the U.S. position, as it's being publicly represented, is a bit odd to me. You would think that some of this stuff, even though, like you said, it is a lot more accessible in an open source intelligence manner nowadays than it might have been even in 2014, which, by the way, they're just starting to begrudgingly acknowledge that this conflict has been ongoing now for many years. This is not a new invasion. This is the incremental move of somebody, I think, over time, just weighing in and slowly encroaching and eventually consuming a territory, as opposed to doing it, you know, with a blitz, with an immediate military move. Eventually, though, it does seem like that is the end game intention. Again, if you strip away this odd communication that's going back and forth. So that is effectively my view of it at this point. And I don't know. It could be that I am not overthinking it, but underthinking. Can you underthink it? I think you can underthink it. I don't know. It's weird because I'm quite accustomed to the idea that he presents a lot of different things publicly. And at the end of the day, that's part of the agenda. But it was never the thrust of the movements. It seemed like he had a lot of other things to gain on the table in all these other situations. And, you know, as we've gone over, it's just, it's odd to me that it almost boils down to just this every time I try and figure out, well, what is really the purpose here? I mean, nobody's going to commit these kind of assets to do nothing, which is, again, is something that sounds like a very mainstream point of view. Why would you put all these soldiers here? I mean, I know that there are things you can gain simply by threatening to do something like this as opposed to actually doing it. But I'm unclear now as to whether that is all there is to it, because it just, that's the only thing that seems out of character here. Yes, he gives you, he basically tells you what he's going to do half the time by telling you, I'm not doing this, you know. And then that's exactly what happens. But weirdly, I almost feel like there isn't a multi-layered agenda in play. It's just, maybe it's just Ukraine belongs to me. I'm going to get there one way or another, and I'm going to do it in slow motion, so to speak. I don't know. What do you think?
I think we can answer the question a bit by a comparison. Let's go back to 2004, 2005, 2004, 2003, 2004. Was the height of what is referred to as Putin's charm initiative. When he was courting Western Europe, Russia joined NATO. I know that shocks people, but Russia had actually executed a certain level of commitment to join NATO in anti-terrorist activities. Mm-hmm. There was a big outreach to the West, to Europe, not necessarily to America as much, but to Europe. Russia wanted European markets, not just for gas, but for other things. And at that point in time, Putin was embarrassed by essentially being defeated in an election in Ukraine. Okay, so how did he react then? Well, what he did then was to essentially go through a series of very smart plays where essentially he brought about regime change in Ukraine. And the way he did it was to essentially demonstrate to Ukraine that the gas that goes through Ukraine was controlled by Russia. Russia controlled Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, the places that really provided the gas. Russia's Gazprom, which is majority owned by the Russian government, did all the business deals. It had handled pricing. Up to that point in time, it had given favorable pricing to all the former Soviet republics, and including Ukraine. Well, Putin was upset with Ukraine, so he turned this all around and essentially forced Ukraine into a new series of price negotiations and demonstrated to them that they had no leverage whatsoever. To really bring that point home to them, he cut off gas supplies, cut back strenuously gas supplies, and advised all the Western nations in Europe that they might suffer an outage, but if they did, it would be Ukraine's fault, because he was going to do this in midwinter, and the only way that Ukraine would survive would be able to take, since they no longer had contract for gas, but they ran the pipeline, they'd have to take Europe's gas, which they did for a few days, but only a few days until he literally browbeat them into a totally new set of contracts. That was economic warfare.
Right.
And he did it without even upsetting Europe that much by essentially putting all the blame and finessing it on Ukraine. That's the way he was playing the game then. And he was playing geopolitics. Russia as an international strategic energy power, you know, be our friend, you know, just that's not the game he's playing today.
Right.
Even at the beginning today, at the beginning of this crisis, there was talk about Russia and Venezuela, Russia and Cuba. You don't even hear that anymore. It's all about Ukraine. And so he's not playing. You can make yourself a strategic player on the world scene by being a threat, but that doesn't bring you anything other than respect, I guess, or fear, whatever. And now, if you look at some of his statements for the last few days, you even have Putin himself talking about nobody really dare oppose what happens in Ukraine. He has nuclear weapons. And, you know, he's been putting the nuclear threat on the table against NATO. And so I guess he's playing the game with much less finesse, much more brutally. And as you were just saying, it may buy him Ukraine. It may buy him a greater Russia. Right. It's not going to buy him any economic advantage. That's just not on the table.
Right.
He's going to hurt his markets. He will raise the price of oil, of course, which will bring him some income for a time. But I don't see – he's just playing the game differently, which is what I think, quite frankly, is frightening everyone because they're used to more cunning, more sophistication, better tactics, and that's not there.
Right, and you brought up something which the chat room is reminding me that I kind of deflected into a different direction when you were talking. You brought up his behavior at the Olympics. And look, I don't know how significant that is, but would you mind explaining it? Because, look, there could be more than one answer about this. You know, as I said, if I'm looking at this from a completely savvy Putin point of view, right? Like you said, the PR campaign, all that went on, I mean, you know, him with the shirtless on horseback and everything, right? All of it. There was a purpose behind that. There was a finesse there. There was the business you talked about, the economic warfare. What about this strange behavior, though, at the Olympics? Because to me, that was a weird signal, too, where he's, you know, shaking hands with Xi and all of that. And obviously, he's doing it to parallel what's going on with Biden trying to solidify the NATO position. So here's the answer. By the way, don't forget, I've got your other friend you might have a problem with a little further away is my friend, right? It's almost like sitting down with, if you were to put this in the criminal world, you know, the loan shark sits down in the restaurant with the hitman. Nobody wants to get their order wrong, okay? So... You know what I mean? It's like, go ahead.
Yeah, there are two levels to that. I think one, it was a grand opportunity for Putin, just because the U.S. and a lot of nations had pulled back on their diplomatic representation, which left him and the Chinese premier the field alone to make third world friends. You know, Putin is very active in the Middle East. Putin is very active in Africa. So, I mean, but you didn't see him doing any diplomacy, which would have been, you know, he's got the field himself. There are only two real world leaders there. He didn't use it for that purpose. So he was very passive. He didn't seize the opportunity, which he always has in the past. I think equally striking was, if you compared it to his behavior at the – Putin has always been a cheerleader. Mm-hmm. He likes to – channel that energy, and if you've seen him at Olympics before, he would kind of he was into what the Russian performers were doing, he would attend all of the Russian performances, he would and some of their allies, and And he was, you know, visibly excited and involved and engaged. Well, during the open ceremonies, they cut to him two or three times when you would have expected them to be doing that, because I'm sure the producers, you know, this is what the guy does. Let's get the cameras on him. He wasn't doing it. And in fact, when the Russians themselves came out, they cut to him, and he was sitting there like he was in a daze, and then suddenly he looks up like, I'm going, did he have an earbud on? Did just somebody just cue him? Was he not even paying attention? And suddenly he looks up and like starts being involved, and that just was so different than his normal persona that it was kind of shocking. I mean, it was shocking to me because it wasn't the Putin that we expect to see.
Well, right, and it doesn't speak to the same guy who was left out of the G8 situation and all that, where, you know, he was basically getting other people to make his case, right, that he belongs among the you know, the global leaders in business and so on and so forth, right? As he was sort of kicked out of some of these diplomatic / you know, corporatist interest circumstances that are, you know, high profile internationally, you would have thought that he would have seized upon this opportunity, certainly, in a friendly nation, to do exactly what you were saying, to kind of present that Russian nationalism. And I mean, it was a little odd to see him like, yeah, I got that same impression. Somebody said, look, you know, it's almost like when you're at a baseball game and somebody turns and goes, you're on the Jumbotron. And, you know, then the guy goes, oh, okay, now I'm going to act up. It was weird like that, right? But I don't know. It's hard to say. And I know there were some rumors for a bit that he was slipping maybe, and maybe he's got some health issues. I don't know if those are true. It's always difficult, you know, to figure this out because, frankly, again, what is one of the things they often do to any leader? Hey, that guy's not quite 100%, you know, one way or another, his health, or maybe he's got a mental problem, he's sick, something. They always try and amplify an apparent weakness that somebody has. I mean, this is just, well, politics. So I don't know if that was true. Or if, you know, you are looking at a guy who just was there for, again, a different reason. We weren't going to see it publicly even. Who knows, right? His activities in the Middle East, his connections with China, those are all important things. And maybe just it was incidental that he was there and just kind of under the cover of being there at the Olympic Games. But then again, maybe there's something else happening here. I mean, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, let's look at one other thing that we know nothing about. Well, we know one thing.
Okay.
Let's look at Putin domestically. There is no sign that Putin has a designated successor. Putin has essentially worked himself into a presidency for life situation. I think that's a fair statement legally. There is nothing to oust him if he wishes to remain in that office forever. He doesn't have any administration, as it were. I mean, his relationships are all personal relationships with oligarchs. And they're the ones, the oligarchs control the parties and essentially control the Duma and through political privilege. It's become a very... I wouldn't want to call it an imperial system, but it probably more in the nature of an imperial system than anything else.
Right.
So, but we know nothing about a successor or any sort of transition. It kind of all rests on Putin. And now, the interesting thing about that, and it's pure speculation, is, you know, if he were... So, Russia is Putin. Putin is Russia. Okay? But at some point in time, I mean... The man is mortal.
Right.
The interesting thing is, what's the upshot that you got out of the last 4 months? What you really got is a constant narrative that says the only person in the world on this planet that knows what Russia is going to do is Putin. There is no Russian government. There is no Russia. There is only Putin. Now, from Putin's own perspective, I mean, that certainly sells him. I mean, who in the world is going to think about, like, Putin is the guy that can hold the rest of the world at bay. Putin holds the largest conventional army on the continent. I mean, Putin is the man. So is it possible that some of this is just to, if he himself felt that he were slipping a little bit, physically, whatever, just to demonstrate to everybody that he's not, that he's the guy? I mean, would you even want to, as a leader, be in a position where the world thinks that it is, again, I hate to do it again, it's much like Hitler and Chamberlain and those folks. It's like the only person who knows what wild, crazy thing Hitler might do is Hitler. Forget about Germany. There's own Germany. There's only Hitler. Well, there's only Putin. There's no Russia.
See, and it's a curious thing because, again, where you have a system which is based on the singular guy, and, again, we don't see, like, you know, his children getting ready to take the reins. I mean, perhaps that's being done completely behind the scenes or something like that. It's actually been difficult to even nail down the existence of his children and things like this, right? You know, so, I mean, there's a possibility that behind the scenes somebody's being groomed, but on the world stage you would have thought that at some point you'd have to introduce somebody. And could it possibly boil down to the, you know, the one leader, one government situation, that this is just part of the legacy that he feels he needs to, I don't know, reinforce? You know, before I was done, here's what I did. But again, it's almost like, I don't know how these guys think. Because, as you said, you know, and as it's been pointed out, look, everybody's mortal. So at the end, there's usually some kind of successor in mind somewhere. You know, even if you don't believe in elections, it doesn't matter. At some point, you realize you're not going to live forever. Somebody's going to have to continue your work after you're gone. And yet, we've never really gotten a hint of that publicly, anyway.
Well, I'm going to bring up something that you've used before, and as far as a description of the system.
Okay.
Essentially, this is my best interpretation. Putin himself converted what was what had been a centralized communist government and a party regime, if you will, and control rested on who was where in the party. He converted it from a floundering democracy, a very actually open and very competitive democracy, into what has more the feel of a criminal state, a godfather state. As far as my understanding goes, and this comes from Russian journalists and a lot of people that wrote about what was happening and then had to escape, some of them being killed later, power in Russia rests in a series of, if you want to call them godfathers, they're not exactly, they're oligarchs.
Right.
And their personal relationships with him are what makes it work.
Right.
So it's not a party system. It is a, I want to call it a business system. You probably got a better description than I do, Chuck, because you've talked about this before.
Right.
But his successors obviously aren't in the party. That his successors are kind of outside where the money is.
Well, see, that's the key, because what you have is a system which he put together in a very pragmatic sense, from what I can gather, right? Where, look, the government was very dysfunctional. The financial system was floundering, but it had potential. But it just couldn't seem to get over certain humps. And I think, quite frankly, that there were people exploiting the weaknesses in the system for their own gains outside of the country is what was going on. And his response to that was to say, well, frankly, you know, what we have for organized crime is functional. Why don't we, instead of trying to figure out how to clear that out, well, they can be very useful. They have infrastructure. And they come into the government and they become what we call oligarchs, basically. I mean, there are various examples of these guys that are clearly exactly that. They were basically the Soviet organized crime, transferred into, well, now we're going to just make you part of the business partnership. And it was very effective. It can be done. Instead of chasing the criminals, make them part of the system. This is what it looked like to me. And only certain ones, you know, the ones that are going to do things the right way. And I think that he adequately not only built a business empire, but a functional government. But again, it's all based on that very structure that is similar to what happens with organized crime, where you have the upper echelon, you know, which benefits from all of what goes on underneath it. The pyramid system, and it worked. It worked very well. I think it's actually unique in our time to see it work as well as he was able to make it function. So, again, some people might dispute my characterization of this a little bit. But frankly, I know that there are easily recognizable examples of this. You know, who is it they keep hitting with these sanctions? Exactly the same guys who, you know, again, a couple of decades earlier, you'd be looking at these guys as Russian organized crime. I mean, that's what they were doing. And here we are. Those organizations, again, sort of metamorphosized into this system and a godfather system. Okay, a little bit inaccurate, but similar ideals. You have a hierarchy that has control over most of what's going on. They work in concert with one another, but they all equally have their separate interests, right? So it allows it to become a functional infrastructure where you can get everything done, because they had it already functional. Even under the Soviet system, there were these guys who were able to function outside of the system. And what do? That system collapses? Well, we'll adopt this as the system. I mean, that's the way I see it. In a nutshell.
It's very efficient. I think a perfect example is the way Putin, in the course of something like only 2 years, mm-hmm. essentially took total control of Russian media. Not by issuing edicts out of the president's office or whatever. He simply had some of his very close friends who were doing well financially from the deals he was allowing them to make, bought mm-hmm. all of the publishing enterprises and the TV networks. And they just bought them. And according to the folks that were working in the system at the time in those media outlets, the new owners would come in and say, well, here's your editorial board, and here's what we're going to be writing. And it was so simple and so straightforward. No, nobody had to issue any orders, or it's capitalism at its best. We just have a new editorial policy. We have new owners. And it was that way across the whole system. We have new owners. Well, this is... we're free, right? We're not even communists. We're capitalists now, and it's just that the new owners are going to tell us what we're going to do.
Right. And simultaneously, he's one of the owners. You know?
Yes.
So, you know, here it is. And like I said, that's why it's weird to look at this Ukrainian situation, because if you think you're entitled to something, okay, and I'm going way outside of the sphere we're talking about here, but... just in, again, if you understand that there's some criminal element to this, okay, realistically, if a territory belongs to you, it belongs to you. This is the attitude by which you function. Now, you may have to take it by force. You may have to take it through intimidation. You may have to take it through, well, just buying it. I mean, doesn't matter how you do it, go get your territory. And I'm wondering if it's just that simple, actually. He feels he's entitled to Ukraine.
It certainly looks like it because of the amazing lack of finesse. We know he has more finesse than this. Mm-hmm. We know he's an excellent tactician. We know he knows how to leverage economics. He's not even... all he's leveraging now is tank battalions and and missile batteries. So it, yeah, the degree of the radical change and lack of finesse is so apparent that I think it's just, I would agree with you, Chuck. I kept looking for something more sophisticated.
Right.
And I'm left with the simple, his concept was that Russian, the Russian cultural ethnocentric being, really new Russia, old Russia, the Russian Empire was violated.
Right.
It was violated at this, at the downfall of the Soviet Union, and it's up to him to change that. And yeah, I think it's just that simple. As you just said, this is Russian. It needs to be Russian again.
Yeah. Sadly, that's where, I mean, look, new information could enlighten us on this. You know what I mean? It's possible that there's something that is being so well done that it's not obvious, but I'm having a hard time finding it. I really am, and I'm one of these guys who goes, okay, I don't want to think about this from the standard. You know me, Larry. I'll go all over the world trying to figure out what the motive is, right? You know, it's like, okay.
We're the conspiracy guys, Chuck. I mean, it's like, okay, what's our native nature is to look for something more sophisticated and behind the scenes.
Right. It's like, you know, look, you bought a piece of steak to cook for dinner, but what are you really trying to say? You know, I mean, this is how I function in life. It's just, it's who I am. I mean, you know, even when I was a kid and a girl wanted to kiss me, I was thinking to myself, what does she want from me? You know, like, this is who I am. And I'm looking at this going, what is the purpose? Because I don't see the financial gain, okay? I don't see how there is a business element to this. Like I said, I thought maybe it was about leveraging the pipeline, but it doesn't pan out when you try and examine this. If it is simply about making a statement or as a distraction, it doesn't make sense. You're not getting away with anything covertly, as you said. It's not like, you know, and that's another funny thing, too, as we come toward the end of this hour, is that I'm watching this accusations go back and forth, and I'm sitting there going, well, you know, if I want to go to some satellite imagery, I can see what this is, and I have. And the truth is not exactly on the side of either side of the propaganda equation here, by the way. You know, from what I can observe from things that are accessible to everybody. Okay. And what am I talking about? Well, they said that, look, we're pulling back our troops. Here's pictures actually of these tanks and everything rolling over this bridge. See, we're pulling back the troops. These movements amount to very little. These assets are arrayed pretty much like the Western media is trying to show you. They're oversimplifying some of it. But either way, you can observe for yourself that there are men and equipments that are arrayed in approximately the same places that the Western media is telling you. He's saying we're pulling back, we're bringing them to bases. What does that actually mean when you take a look at what that could mean? I mean, if you have established a base just on the border there, is it okay to do so? I guess so. It's your territory up to that border, isn't it? You have your sympathizers there. Well, I'm not really responsible for those guys, even though you probably are. You know, much like Estonia, who's still, you know, having a face down, which nobody's even talking about, by the way. Estonia is still having this issue with Russia. They're sending aid to Ukraine, okay, which I found really strange. But either way, it got there. So, you know, whatever you want to say about that. This is what I can discern, but either way, the back and forth about, no, I'm not really positioned to attack, you know, I'm still willing to negotiate, doesn't look that way. And our government, who I don't trust to begin with, I'm not saying that it's as imminent a hostile situation, because even this week they tried to convince us that as of yesterday, Larry, we should be talking about a very hot situation right now. The full-on invasion should have occurred already, based on all these projections and signals, and oh, it might be Wednesday. I don't know if you caught all that, but here we are in a situation where I still can't get over what is the other gain here. there's nothing even to negotiate with that I think is actually in play that you can gain by saying, all right, listen, I'll back off. Give me this. You know,
here's my best guess, Chuck. And I think I hate to say this. It reminds me a bit of Vietnam from the other direction. I think the best I can tell is that Putin was starting to play his regular game. I mean, he had enough force in place 2 months ago to seize all of the separatist regions and link them up. And I do think that I do believe there were plans in place because it's his game plan. I mean, if he hadn't done it so often before, for false flag operations for them, for regime change actions, political actions in Kiev, I think there were things in play that didn't work for him.
Okay.
And it, because if there was a false flag, it shouldn't be now when everybody will know what's going on. It should have been 2 months ago.
Right.
So I think something failed. One or more things failed. And so then he reverted back from, you know, plan A to plan B, which is intimidation. And he's done this before. And I would not have been surprised. And you got to remember, Putin thinks this is Russia. He's intimidated him before. He's done regime change at least three times in Ukraine since he came into power. When he moved those forces up, he expected them to fold.
Right.
I really think, and they didn't. And now he's stuck, kind of like we went through an iterative series of steps in Vietnam where we could have extracted ourselves. We didn't.
Right.
We just, now that occurred over years. This is occurring over months. But I think he may have, something didn't happen. This is not Putin. So I have to believe that it was more intelligently planned in the beginning. Something didn't work, and he's running into a difficulty gracefully extracting himself and may have no option other than just to go to the brute force, demonstrating he's not going to back down. What can I say?
No, that's kind of where I'm coming to as well, because I just don't see another motive, but... Anyway, look, I really appreciate you taking the extra time with us tonight because, as I said, we started a little bit late. But I want you guys to and I promise you, Larry's not like just my Ukraine guy on the show, okay? I just, in case people are like, gee, he went from JFK guy to Ukraine guy. No, I'm going to discuss a lot of different topics with Larry as they emerge. It's just that the news continues to be this. And frankly, we have to continue to cover what is happening. And that's what I intend to do with Larry, actually, is, you know, adapt the various things that he studied in the past, written about in the past, and say, look, you know, let's go further with it. What would we have to write about today as these events unfold? And really, I had it in mind at some point to start talking to you about UFOs by now. you know, but...
I'm ready.
Listen, I know you're ready, and I'd love to talk to you about the national security response to Unidentified Things, which coincidentally is the name of Larry's book, Unidentified. And, you know, this is what I would love to talk to you about, but instead, I wind up talking to you about the book Creating Chaos, which is another good one, for sure. And unfortunately, not a lot of chaos being created, but something else is happening on the world stage here regarding, and I don't mean unfortunately like, gee, I love chaos, but I mean, frankly, it's not playing out as you wrote about, exactly. But at the same time, it's recognizable. So this is the curious thing as we had basically analyze what is going on currently in our world today. And more than happy to have Larry Hancock with me to do so, because he is a great analyst and somebody who understands the behaviors of the national security states of, well, mainly the U.S., but he's had to look at other places because can't take it out of context. And Larry, one thing we love with you is context, my friend. Larry, listen, I'll give you the website. I'll give you links to his books and also a link to go ahead and pick up Creating Chaos, which sadly continues to be so, so relevant. But Larry Hancock, thanks again for doing this with me.
I enjoy it, Chuck, as always.
And in 2 weeks, Larry will be back. And, you know, look, I have a great hope for peace in all situations. I would rather not see bloodshed anywhere. And I say again that I pray for the people of Ukraine that they do not have to suffer, whether this is an egomaniacal movement by Vladimir Putin or this is some other agenda at play. I guess we'll have to see as it unfolds. But frankly, I just don't want to see people suffer for whatever those that are in power wish to gain. And that doesn't matter where it happens in this world. So anyway, Larry Hancock once again. In the first hour, we had Mike Swanson tonight. That's the Thursday Ocelli Effect. So don't forget, no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.